You're listening to Casual Talk Radio, where common sense is still the norm. Whether you're a new or longtime listener, we appreciate you joining us today. Visit us at casualtalkradio.net. And now, here's your host, Leister.
A recent episode talking about purchasing, property purchasing, seemed to be fairly popular. And I committed that I was going to elaborate a little bit based on other information that was not directly related to my purchase, but just overall history, walk through time, et cetera, and so on. And I will just preface, I am battling something at the moment, so there may be awkward pauses. I apologize, but it's what it is. So just to elaborate further, I made the statement. I said, you have to understand when you're about to buy property, home, condo, town, whatever, or even an apartment, you have to stop and think about what you really need. If I think back, that was one thing I could do better, but I didn't have, arguably, the school system doesn't educate you to these things. They don't tell you about what you need to know to actually survive in the real world. When you're in elementary school, you learn the basics. Arguably, what you learned in elementary, it's probably changed since I went, but what you learn in elementary is the vast majority of what you need to know. I learned later, there are some kids who were never taught about currency, actual cash, and that's sad, to not know your denominations. I literally just had a kid, didn't know all you got to do is pull out two dimes and a nickel and four pennies or a quarter and four pennies, either way. He struggled with it. So you should be taught these things because this myth that everything is just going to be a swipe of the card away is just that. But also, you have to understand, if you don't know how to count currency and denominations, how can you be on the lookout for when you're getting ripped off when you go to these places? I think there's an assumption that everything is more accurate because there's computers, and so they don't pay attention to the money flowing out of your account. You might be surprised to learn. When you're swiping the card, you don't realize it, but subconsciously you're going to spend more money because it's easier to spend. You have cash, you can only spend what you carry with you. You should not carry a vast majority of cash. So cash helps constrain budget. The same concept applies when you're going to go purchase a home. There, you're dealing with checks, you're dealing with bank transfers. I know that we're in a world where Venmo and Cash App and all this garbage is kind of at front, but you should be aware of how checks work. You should be aware of how money orders work. You should be aware of how bank transfers work. You should be aware of how MoneyGram works, how Western Union works. You should be aware about basic bank interactions that have to do with cash. Because when you go to do this purchase, and even apartments, but when you go to do this purchase, you're going to be asked for one of these forms of tender. You're not going to be able to use your phone to get away with it. In an apartment, usually, not always, but usually they're going to want first month, last month, some deposit, something. And they're going to want it, not always, but usually it's like a money order. Did you know that you can get a money order from the postal office, right? Did you know that you can do that? Maybe you didn't. Did you know that if you can find a local money tree, they do money orders? Did you know that your bank, even if it's not where you have your funds stored, but you know your local bank can probably do money orders? Do you know the difference between a bank check, a cashier's check, and a money order? Chances are a lot of this is down in the weeds. And that's, again, a failure of our education system, because these are more important things that I think you should be learning in high school versus the garbage they saddle you with. But that's my opinion. If you have to produce a cashier's check, which sometimes you may have to, a cashier's check essentially says the bank is going to guarantee that money. Many organizations prefer cashier's checks over regular checks that you would write, or a bank check, which is nothing more than a personal check that the bank writes for you. Because the certified check, the cashier's check, is essentially guaranteed funds, and they like guaranteed money. A money order should be guaranteed money. Not every organization treats it as guaranteed money. it's critical you understand when each one needs to apply and the limits of each. The money order has dollar limits. If it's a cashier's check, certain banks, you have to bank with them for you to get access to it, so on. Bank transfers, and I do not refer to Venmo or Cash App. I'm talking about ACH. The idea that I can go to my bank and just request a regular transfer, it takes 24 hours, or I can do a wire. Usually a wire is about an hour, maybe two. These are transferring from your bank to another bank, not from your phone. Your phone may have an app that lets you do it. The point is your phone's not really doing the transaction. It's done at the bank by humans. Because it's done by humans and not by technology, these are generally trusted forms of money transfer. All of what I just described, again, these are things that your high school should be teaching, and they don't. I know they don't. How to count currency. Your elementary should be teaching, if they don't anymore, because it certainly doesn't seem like it, because I see less and less kids knowing how to count currency, which is troubling to me. Knowing how to write a check, knowing how to balance an account. To me, and rushing away from the plastic, to me, that's what we should teach, is the fundamentals of how to do things. And we don't. So then what happens when you grow up, become 18 or older, and now you're ready to sit on your own? Well, first, it's a terrifying time, isn't it? You're a little afraid to go out on your own. I was excited to go out on my own. I was excited to basically say I'm not going to look back, because I knew it would force me to step up. That's missing today's youth. The fear is kind of cultivated. You know, we celebrate that fear. We coddle. There are stories of kids who stay at home to like 30 something years old. That's mind boggling to me, but it is what it is. I've known people that have done that. I don't understand it, because I don't know how you could tolerate that. But being told what to do by your parents, because that's what's going to happen all the way through, because you're in their home, right? And essentially you're a freeloader. And some kids are actually happy doing so. I was not going to be that. I did everything in my power to get out of there, because it was going to force me to step up. And I knew it was going to help long term, and I think it did. So what was the first step? Well, my first step was the bad step. My first step happened randomly. I met a girl, and I forget exactly how we met. I know it was a blind setup, but I forget the specifics. Blind setup, talked to her on the phone, really sweet gal. And we went on a first date to like some haunted house, something or other. Sure. Okay, seemed cool. This is where I learned that she was under lock and key, and there's a long story behind this. But the point is, she asked me to move in with her. Okay, fine. It got me out of the home. I didn't move everything out, but I moved the core essentials and some things I regret having done. But because of this lock and key she was under, it wasn't going to work. But what it gave me was a taste of what it was like, a sample of what it was like to not be in my parents' home, and to be kind of on my own and calling the shots. And I liked what I felt. I liked the way it worked. That may be a suggestion if you're younger. To get a sample of it, possibly consider renting a room from someone else so that you're out of that home. You will have to answer to that person, potentially, but it gets you away from your parents' house. Lets you sample what it's like to be on your own. Obviously, you need to be 18 so that you can be, or an emancipated minor, so that you can take advantage of it. The point is, if you get an opportunity to do it, that may help you tiptoe into and feel what it's like. Some will still say, I don't like this. I like that safety. I like that certainty. But is it really certainty? Or potentially, are you a burden? Consider if you're a burden. If you're a burden, and they'll not tell you that you're a burden, some will, but most won't. But think, are you a burden? Are you burdening them? If you are, why do you want that? Why do you want to continue to do? How is that serving them any, when all it's asking of you is to be autonomous and be independent? What some will do, which I didn't, but some will do, is they will shack up with somebody they're dating. I moved in with them, but I was paying. You know, it was not free. You know, so sometimes it's like, okay, I will find a significant other and I'll shack up with them, or I'll go to college and we're going splits on the rent or dorms, right? All of these are viable ways to move out on your own and kind of test the waters and see what it's like, and then eventually cut the umbilical cord. No problem with it. But if you're always sharing if you're always splitting, if the cost is always borne partially by somebody else, you never understand what it really is going to take for you to self-sustain. The reason that matters is because if something happens to those other people, you're going to be screwed and not know what to do about it. I think society has lost the idea of the what-ifs or the focus on the what-ifs. How to build yourself in a way where you're prepared for the what-ifs. If, let's say, you have two or three people, friends, and you decide to be roomies and you split the rent three ways or something. So, okay, my rent's only $300 a month and you work at Burger King, so that works for you, right? Well, what happens if one of those friends loses their job? Are you going to be able to pick up their slack, which is going to be an extra $150 on each of you? Or is that going to cause contention between you because of whatever happened? What if that friend decides to shack up with their significant other? What if that friend dies? My point is, are you thinking about the what-if situations that drive your decision to go in that way? See, I never went in the split route. The one time I rented a room, and it was a higher upper middle class family, and I rented a room in the home, so I am a shared split, but I didn't stay there forever, nor was I going to, because I knew it was going to be a nightmare. There was all sorts of drama with that I'm not going to bore you here. But the point is, I already committed I wasn't going to stay there, because what happens if these other two move out? And one of them was a foreign exchange student, never there. There's all sorts of ifs that I had to think about. And then there was car repairs and work, how much money I was or wasn't making, all different things that I had to really say, this is not going to be a long-term thing. I'm only here because I need to kind of bridge until I can get to my own. I get to my own. Now it's on me to start thinking about rent, not just the basics of rent, because what I didn't know at the time was, you know, they'll happily raise your rent whenever they feel like it. Deep, deep, deep. I had to think about food, and not just fast food. I had to think about gas more than I did because I was further away from work. I had to think about all the other things I needed to do for my studying and everything else that now I'm on the hook for. So the rent bill was nothing. It was everything else that was going into it. If you're about to break out on your own, and I don't think anybody listening to the show is, but maybe you are, if you're about to break out on your own, I would recommend the first question you ask yourself is this really what I want? Whatever that is. So if it's an apartment, if it's renting a room, if it's buying something, is this really what I want? Some of you may come from families where you have the luxury of buying something. I didn't. Just wasn't going to happen. Some of you may have the luxury of working in an area with a really low cost of living, but you work for a company that pays you a decent amount. I didn't. So everybody's situation is going to be different. Everybody's going to have certain advantages and disadvantages that they have to navigate around. Let's assume that you're in that situation of buying a home. And in the last episode, I talked about my journey of buying a home, which I've learned in the place that I'm at. Basically, the bottom line is everybody plays hardball. So now that I know the game, I know how to play it. I know how to play hardball. And there's a lot that I know about home buying and selling. And I'm using that knowledge many people don't ever get because our school system doesn't teach you about these kinds of things. But I learned everybody just hardballs. So I talked about the other place, and that one backed down. They basically said, nope, we're not taking your offer. And I said, okay, kick rocks. And then they came back and said, oh, well, we'll get within $2,000 what you want. And I told them to kick rocks again. Because even at that one, I didn't want the house at all. It wasn't that good. It's not. It was the land. It was on like half an acre of land. I wanted the land, not the house. House was garbage. So I told them to kick rocks. Well, then I got another one. And this other one, visually, I talked about how it reminds me of my grandparents' house. It's not a great house, but it's certainly not terrible. It's, you know, it's workable, but it needs a lot of work. But it's livable. I would say there's some things that I check, but it's generally livable. But there were things I wanted to fix, and I wanted them to go part on it. And I said, here's what I'm offering. You eat part of it, I'll eat part of it, and we'll meet in the middle. And the way I position the offer, and this is kind of one of those things I'll talk about here. The way I position the offer, when you are doing the home, the first thing you should always do, always, is get your money in order. Get your money right. When I say get your money right, you need to make sure you have a solid, reliable, provable source of recurrent income of a certain level that proves it's easy for you to make the monthly payments. For the most part, as long as whatever the monthly payment is going to be, as long as you're making more than like three times that amount-ish, the bank will work with you. I recommended having a 20% down. I don't suggest that it's easy to do it. I'm saying I recommend doing it because it gives you power. It gives you leverage. When you come in to the offer, it's written as part of the offer. You're coming in saying, I got a loan and I'm 20% down in on the loan, showing I got money to work this. The only thing more appealing is going to be a cash buyer. A cash buyer is somebody who, and that might not be somebody super wealthy. It could be just somebody who had a home. There are stories of homes like in Southern California before it built out where they bought it for like $16,000 and they sold it for like $800,000. These are real stories. So it's a different time. My point is that people that bought way back, right at the point where a home was starting to appreciate and they made a mint on the home, they can just pocket that extra as the equity when they sell it and then go buy something that they really want. Those can be cash buyers. You're coming in saying, I already got the money on deck. We're ready to go. There's no loan. There's nothing. Now, the downside of a cash buyer, the only downside, I would argue, of a cash buyer, with a cash buyer, they're generally less likely to accept your asking price fresh out the gate. They're going to try to negotiate it down, as they should. You know, you should always try to get a deal. Shouldn't try to pay full price unless it's perfect. None of the homes are perfect. I'll talk about that in a second. With a loan buyer, they're more likely to be closer to the price you want, or they may ask for some discounts, but it's for a reason. You know, there's something with the house we find. There's something with the neighborhood we find. So this second one that I put an offer in, here's the story and how it ties back. Again, I like the home, but it's got problems. There's things that need to be fixed. It's certainly not the lowest crime area. I wouldn't say it's not a slum, nowhere close, but it's not the lowest crime area. In fact, there's like a Catholic church that's like a block away and it's marked in red as far as crime zone. I found that kind of interesting. So between that, like location, kind of weird, things I need to get fixed. And it's on not a crazy busy street, but there's like schools that front it. All of this together, to me, kind of brought the price down. And so I said, all right, let's cut the price. And I'm talking about how this works. You come in and then you say, all right, I'll offer you this. And it could be they're asking or it could be a little bit lower. We do an inspection. So now you hire, as the buyer, somebody to come in and do a deep inspection of certain things. There's certain things they don't do unless you ask for it, but high level, deep inspection to understand all these things that you're going to have to fix. Or there could be certain non-negotiable things, right? It's like, these are non-negotiable things. These have to be fixed. Or you just take it all on. The inspection is your leverage. You can say these things need to be fixed and it's going to be $50,000. Like in my case, it was $60,000 worth of fixes. Okay. What I normally do, it's your home, so I'm assuming you want to sell it and get out of it because that's why it's on the market. All right, well, I need you to, you know, I got five on it, you know, and I need you to come in a little bit on your side. So you come in a little bit and I'll come in a little bit and we make the deal. And all this I'm describing to you, if you're newish to buying, you're not going to know this stuff. This is stuff that you're not taught in school like you should be. And your realtor might not be ethical enough to tell you, and that's a whole different story. I know because I went through this process multiple times and I saw the game because I got gamed on the one house I did buy. And I wasn't going to let that happen again. So here I'm saying, okay, come down to this price and fix this. They basically came back and said, well, we'll cut the price down, but nowhere. It was like $3,000. No, that's not going to work for me, brother. So I said, look, let's make one final deal. If it doesn't work, walk away. Like I'm not wasting time with this business. That's the one lesson I would tell everybody, in addition to what I said, don't spend too much time, unless it's like a dream home. And if it's a dream home, would you still consider it a dream home minus the $60,000 worth of repairs? Because you could be looking at rose-tinted glasses and saying, well, it looks like an amazing home. That's what this one is. It looks like an amazing home on the inside. It's got all these amazing features and all this great stuff, but it also has fundamental issues that you can't see. Those are going to bite you at some point. And so if you're okay, because it's got such potential, you're willing to invest that, that's one thing. But if it's like, I wouldn't say it's catastrophic, but there's fire risks, there's other things to think about. When I say, as you go through the process, you have to be thinking about these things. You got to be thinking about fire risk. You can't assume that somebody that's been in a home, and the older it gets, the worse it is, I would argue. If it's a home that's older, did they do anything to upgrade these things like they should have? There's things we learned over time that should have contributed to home upgrades. Asbestos. Asbestos was a big thing. It contributes to cancer. So they should have gotten rid of it in some of the older homes. It was for fire, da 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 da. Some did not get rid of it. Tiles. There's tiles that have asbestos in them that were used in entryways. Did they get rid of those tiles to get rid of the asbestos? These are things that you won't see. And so it looks nice, but if, let's say you have a kid and they disturb this stuff, that dust can be health hazardous. You might have pipes. You might have electrical that's loose or frayed or rodents or something else that you don't see. So you're going in thinking it's something and it turns out to be something way worse. Now, I'm not trying to freak you. I'm saying you have to go through this process of thinking about what you really want to watch out for. And not just go in simply because it's a pretty home or it's in a nice neighborhood. There's more to it that may or may not affect the negotiations. So when I tell them, okay, come down on the price a little bit. I need you to meet me and fix this. They told me no. All right, fine. And then they didn't do my second offer. The second offer I did was lower. The reason is because, and this is something they don't tell you, the realtors and anybody, and even my realtor didn't know. There's in taxes. When you sell a home, there's a threshold and it targets capital gains taxes. So everything that you do around money is going to be taxed at some level, right? You have consumption-based taxes in the form of sales taxes. You have income taxes. You have estate taxes if you inherit something from deceased folks. You have capital gains taxes from your investments. You also have capital gains taxes on the profit, basically the proceeds of homes you sell. So think that also you're buying a home. It could be a condo, townhome, doesn't matter, but you're buying something with a mortgage. Let's say you pay it off. Let's say you own it now free and clear. You want to go sell this to somebody else. Presumably, you want to sell it at a profit. The profit might not be anything that you did. Could be that the home just appreciated, like the examples I gave. They buy it at 16 grand and then sell it at 800 grand. They're getting nailed on capital gains taxes to sell that home. And so what some will do, there's tricky ways that you can, you know, pass down a home to a child or other things to try to avoid or delay those capital gains taxes, but they're going to get you, you know. So I'm thinking, all right, well, you guys want to sell this home. Let me sweeten it a little bit by cutting your tax bill down. So if you go lower on the price down to this threshold, it basically nullifies your capital gains. So you don't get a check up front as much as you might want. But I'm negating essentially $10,000 worth of taxes come 2025. Well, they completely shot me down. So I told my agent, all right, well then tell them to kick rocks and we'll just walk and let's start the next round of home searches. Cause I have like 6 or 7 or 8 in queue that I was going to evaluate. And I'm like, and he was like, okay, let's go ahead and do that. And we did this over the weekend. Then I get a contact this morning, early morning. And he says, you know, I talked to the agent cause I had talked him through this whole capital gain situation to help him understand why I basically backed out 3 days off scratch. It was because I assumed they were really motivated to get out of the home and that they were open to different ways of saving money, because doing it my way saves them 10,000 bucks. It saves me, 25,000 bucks. We both win. That's how I'm thinking it. they're likely thinking, well, yeah, but it's cutting into our check up front, which it is. I'm thinking big picture, you know, I'm thinking bigger. And so I just explained it to him. This is why I backed out 3 days out. He contacts me and says, well, I talked to the listing agent, the seller's agent, and they're going to talk to their client and get them to down to this number because my agent likely talked to their agent and explained to them what I was doing. It's like, I'm trying to help you guys out here, bro. Because if you take my deal, you're going to save major amounts of money long-term. The tax bill is going to be nothing. It'll be like $3,000 instead of $10,000. I get what I want. It's not exactly the price I'm cool with, but if you come down to there, I can make it work. And then to just, you know, you're paying $15,000 towards the fixes I got to do. I still got to pay $35,000, but that's certainly better than, you know, having to pay the whole shot 60. So he came back and apparently the agent was able to get their seller to sign off on it. They sent me the form and I approved it. And then it went to the bank to do all this. My point, and the reason I told that story, they basically hardballed just like the first one. You know, it's like the moment I say walk away, all of a sudden you're coming back and you're open to my offers that you weren't open to up front. And that's cool. If that's the game, then I'll play it. I had the flexibility to do that because I put 20% down. So I've got the leverage. It's like, you're probably not going to find somebody else coming in with 20% down. The price that you want for the home, we still have to go through an appraisal. I doubt the appraisal is going to come at your price. And here's how sketchy this is. If the appraisal is lower than the asking that you agree to, you have to pay the difference out of pocket. So that means high. So even if you did 20% down, let's say it's $15,000 shorter from the price, you're going to have to come up with that $15,000 somehow between you and the seller. The seller's not going to do any more. Okay. So for me, I'm again looking at it as the appraisal. There's no way with this level of issue that the appraisal is going to come anywhere close to your price. We got to come down this business. Let's come to this number. And I was able to make that work. We still have to do the appraisal that's presumably been ordered here soon to see if we can move this forward. Assuming we have no problems, which I have no idea, but assuming we still have no problems with this and we can move it forward, freaking forward finally, the last step then is to, you know, tell my current place what I'm doing. I'd already paid the rent for a couple months to buy some time to let the process flow. I don't know if this is going to work. All my stuff's done at this point. It's now in the hands of, you know, banks and agents and title and all that other stuff to see if this can move forward and bring this to a close. Looks like the target for that is end of May. So that's right on deck for when I need to pay the next deal. So I would tell the current place, you know, I'll just do month to month and not renew the current and just stay here. Well, if you're going in the situation, I just hit you with a bunch of stuff that's all gobbledygook to you, right? But that's because I went through the process at least once and I understood how it generally flows. And the only difference from state to state is here, they just play hardball straight out of scratch. They're not flexible. They just play hardball, which is fine. And in other places, they may be flex. They may be willing to work with you. So I knew what to do. You would not know what to do. So you'll have to trust your realtor to kind of guide you. It starts with knowing what you want though. So you're going to need to know, are you going in as a family, as in, you know, wife, kids, husband, kids, whatever, pets, right? You're going to need to be thinking about schools. If you've got kids or will have kids, because that's part of the plan. If you plan to have kids and you plan to be there for a while, proximity to schools is important. And most of the sites will tell you, there are certain schools that are earmarked for your location. You're going to need to understand the scoring for those schools. Some schools suck. They flat out suck, but they're the school assigned to that property. I remember when I went to high school, the high school and the junior high school that were selected for my address were both rated garbage because they were garbage. I would argue, junior high wasn't terrible, but it wasn't great. And in high school was a catastrophic nightmare, terrible school. It may have improved since, but I don't think so. But my childhood friends all went what's called out of district. So they went to a different school versus the one that was selected for our address. So very few of the people I grew up with actually went to that school, at least fresh out of junior high. Some would go later for like a year or something, but the vast majority of them did not go to that high school, which it didn't surprise me, but it disappointed me. There were actually even people that I knew from junior high that transferred to a different out from that school to a different school. I describe that because as if your parents are going to be parents in this new place, these are things you should think about. The schools that are earmarked for your address to be, and actually assess them and evaluate them and the quality of education, the things that they're taught, but also not just the lessons and the source material, but also the morals and the ethics and belief systems that should be shared to make sure that they're not being taught things that are not in conformance with what you believe. That you don't want certain things taught to your kid that are not consistent with what you're teaching them off the side, that your kid's not being mistreated at school, that your kid is getting the right type of attention. You know, some of these schools, they have too many kids in the class, and so the quality of education degrades. Now, all of that's covered. They want you to use that because your tax dollars go to paying these teachers and schools. But if they're not consistent with what you want, I don't recommend that you do. It's just that when you buy something, condo, house, townhome, whatever, they've already pre-selected the schools from a district perspective that your kid should go to unless you have a compelling reason not to. And then you have to jump through hoops to have them go through a different school. There's no wrong answer. It's what you want to do. A lot of parents, I think, simply default to what's available because of cost. That may be the course that you take up front. Consider if somebody in the family is going to be military to where it's going to be disruptive to the children and you have to move around. Maybe it doesn't make sense to buy something because you know that you're going to have to uproot and move when they get deployed somewhere else. All of these are part of the thought process when I say, make sure you know what you want. Make sure you know what to expect. Make sure you know, have a plan before you ever talk to a lender. Once you get to the lender, you still have some flex, but the lender is going to expect that you're signing a contract for a specific home. It's not like, you know, just get a random loan and then get any home that you want. You know, it still has to make sense from your income. It has to make sense for your credit. It has to make sense for the size of home you really need. It has to make sense for the neighborhood that you plan to live in. Then the loan should fit according to the ratio for your credit and finances. And you have to anticipate things. Don't buy based on bonuses you may not get. You know, buy based on money you know you're getting as salary. And buy when you know that you've got some comfort at your job. If you just start a new job, You're still on pins and needles. They could absolutely cut you, and then you're going to be left in the lurch. And trust me, the last thing you want on your credit is a home foreclosure. And the last thing you want is to be evicted from your own home. Let's say you get past all that. Let's say you're comfortable. You know what you want to do. You know how the school thing should work. You know the kind of home that you're looking for. Now you're trying to assess price and what you can afford, budget. When you budget for the home, you can't just budget for the house itself. You've got to budget for the land, aka property taxes, because although you own the home, and although you technically own the land, there's other things to think about. Depending on the age of the home, there may be an HOA, a homeowners association. I talked about it in my situation. It was a little old lady down the street. Almost every HOA, they have what's referred to as the bylaws. You need, if you're going to go there, make sure you read the bylaws, because the bylaws probably say something to the effect of, if you don't pay your property taxes or you don't pay your HOA dues, we can take your house. And you're like, if you don't pay your dues to the HOA or you don't pay your property taxes, they almost always can seize your house. Regardless of owner of nothing, it doesn't matter. You could own it free and clear, paid off, deed in hand. If you don't pay the taxes or the dues for the HOA, chances are they can seize the house. That's the downside of the HOA. You don't really own anything under HOA. You own it as long as you keep them happy. You can't have your broken down car in the front yard or they can seize your house. You can't paint it off pink because they can seize your house. Like, that's how petty this business is. So when you go in, make sure if there's an HOA, you read those bylaws. Read them. If you need help, contact an attorney to help you interpret what it means. I can almost guarantee you every last one of them is going to say something that says they can take your house, get your house took if you don't follow their rules. It's not really yours. If there's not an HOA, you still can get your house took if you don't pay your taxes, but at least there it's the state, right? It's a lien and it's the state and that's understood. But you, even if you own the land, quote unquote, you still have to pay taxes on the land. You have to account for taxes on the land. You have to account for the mortgage payment that you're paying. You have to account for homeowners insurance. You now are basically, as a given, have to account for internet access of some kind because phone is governed over the internet. You can say, well, I'll just do my cell phone. That assumes that it's going to work in that area. It assumes it's reliable in that area. You might consider getting the regular phone service, but it's all internet-based now. They got rid of the copper. You need to account for this. If it's got a sewer tie-in to the municipal sewer system, you need to pay and account for a sewer bill of some kind. You're going to need to account for electrical. You might be thinking, well, I'll just put solar. Solar is very expensive if it didn't already come with it. And if it did come with it, it's probably going to skyrocket the price of the home. So chances are you're going to have to pay an electrical bill of some kind. In some areas, you're probably going to have to pay to have the sidewalks snow plowed. Yes, if it's a sidewalk in front of your home, you're kind of on the hook to make sure snow plowing is done and safety. It's kind of put on you in the vast majority of areas. You have to account for these. Landscaping, you have to account for this. Trash disposal, you have to account for this. All of these are extra expenses that nobody really thinks of, but you really should. In some cases, when you rent, some of those are covered by the property manager. When you purchase, they're not so much. If it's an HOA property like a condo building, in some cases, it's part of the condo association fee, rarely. You have to account for repairs that may come up. Your siding, depending on the type of siding, your siding is going to have some issues at some point. Your foundation is going to have some issues at some point. Your electrical is going to have issues at some point. Your insulation is going to have issues at some point. Your roofing is going to have issues at some point. Your water piping is going to have issues at some point. Your doors are going to have issues at some point. Your windows are going to have issues at some point. Your HVAC system, heating and venting and air conditioning, are going to have issues at some point. Your bathrooms are going to start having problems. Your kitchen is going to start having problems. Security is something you have to think about. I'm describing, and I haven't even given you the full list, but I'm describing all of these other tertiary expenses that nobody thinks about, but you're going to need to when you go into purchase. Now, a lot of these are not covered in the upfront mortgage. They're part of your budgeting. Budgeting is how you understand what your monthly bill is going to look like every single month going forward with this new change. When you rent, you should be budgeting things like how much food does your household need? If it's a household of one, presumably it's less. If it's a household of four, presumably it's more. All the different utility bills you have to account for, all your internet stuff you have to account for. Everything that goes into living somewhere should be part of your budgeting plan, and you should readjust your budgeting plan if you plan to purchase a home. And what does that look like? A lot of people do not do so, and they really should, because if they did, you would probably find that you're not financially capable of purchasing a home yet, and it may take dual income. Even in dual income, like there's some dual incomes that don't make more than $60,000, $70,000 a year. I can tell you, in most states west of the Rockies, you're not buying a good home for that much money per year. You're going to need to make much more than that. And you're wondering, well, it feels like a rat race. Yeah, that's what it is. It is now. It wasn't before, but it is now, absolutely. Abso-fraggin-lutely. There was a time, I said it. And, you know, to be fair, Chicago, right? You can buy a home on a credit card, but that's the other thing to think about. Security. Just because they help, because you could find homes that are cheap. Okay, is it a safe neighborhood? Probably not. You have to look at crime in the area. Not just property type crime, but bodily crime. Crime to your kids, right? You have to think about all these things in your shopping. And it's going to, all of this together, creates a price target. And you say, that's basically what I can afford and what I can justify. And that number is going to be higher than what you thought it could or should be. If you're on the low end of income, you're going to have to settle lower, but you have to understand if you're settling lower, there's a direct correlation between low income and high crime. There's numbers all over the place. So if you have to settle for those things, you have to understand that the crime is going to be a higher risk. And if you're trying to build a family, you have to take that into consideration. Is that what I want to do? And sometimes you may have no choice, especially if it's a temporary solution. I apply the same logic to mobile home parks. Mobile home parks is a reason that they're referred to as trailer park trash, because in the mainstream, when I say mainstream, I'm talking outside bubbles. In the mainstream, the thought is that trailer parks are filled with drugs and crime and whatever else, and there's numbers to back that up. It's not the common, but it is there. So if you go there, that's risk. And you have to understand, is that all I can do? Is that all I can justify? And if I had enough to rent in a safer place versus buy in a lower crime, perhaps I consider renting, knowing what I said before, it takes a long time to save 20% down. I am not telling you that's easy. It's not. But perhaps you have to think about safety. You have to think, perhaps I just got to bite the bullet and just rent for now, and then find a way to increase income in the household. Legally, obviously. Find a way to increase income in the home so that you can afford more. Barring all of what I just described, and I left this for last because I don't recommend it, but I have to, in all fair disclosure, say it. Most states have programs to help with down payment assistance, programs to help with closing costs, programs to help for low-income families get into decent homes. Now, the catch is there are certain counties that they're trying to help populate that are lesser counties. They're not getting a lot of people in these counties, and they want more people in those counties. So the program is designed to entice more people to go there because they know that the more people that go there, the more tax revenue, right? So these programs are designed to help bridge it. Let's say you can't put 20% down. You could put 5% down, which is a lot easier for some people. And you could do FHA. You do one of these programs and it could help fill the gaps on those things. Sure, but there's always catches. I talked about one of the catches before, how they can yank it from you at the last minute. I'm not suggesting you don't avail yourself of those programs. I'm suggesting you be careful and don't overly rely on that it's going to be it's in your best interest. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's just a scam. I'm honest. Even as a state program, some of them are scams. They're destined to trap you into something. So to me, my recommendation is to figure out how to increase how much money you make to make it easier to save more down. At least get to 10% down, but try to target 20%, which may mean, and this is another thing to think about. I have a friend I used to work with, and she refuses to leave California. I tried to get her to elope, whatever. And she refuses to leave California. She just will not leave California. Even though she'll complain about the prices of things in California. And I'm telling her, if you just elope with me here, between the money you make and the money I make, we could probably live like kings and queens deep, deep. And she just won't do it. You may be in an area that's pricing you out. That's another thing. Subconsciously, I get it. You like the whatever, sunshine, beaches, whatever it is that's keeping you there. But if you really want to be in a safe place that's good enough for family, that's hopefully got some good jobs around, maybe it just makes sense to pack up and go to another state. And also consider if the states out there, the one that you're in compared to the ones you could go to, are more in alignment with your values and your beliefs. Some states might be closer to what you really believe than the one that you're at. You might see a dramatic shift away from your own value principles. Well, why would you stay there? Why would you enrich them with your tax dollars? Again, beaches, sun, I understand. I would rather be in a place that's more in alignment with what I believe, because there you're going to get along better with your neighbors. Sometimes the fast life is what people want. Sometimes the slow life is what people want. I would argue most people don't want to be in crime-ridden places, and there's numerous causes for those situations. I'm saying that if you want safety and you want to try to build a home and you want to try to get, you know, the dream, right? The American dream, which isn't really anymore, but you want to get there, be thinking about all of what I just talked about. There's a lot to think about. It's not easy. That's why there's realtors to try. They're supposed to try to help you navigate those waters. The best source, though, is somebody that's gone through it. I'm talking an actual buyer and even possibly a seller to help you understand everything they had to go through to be able to do it, especially if they've done it a couple times. I think those are the best sources of that information. So your parents even might have gone through it and are willing to talk through it. It's just that things have changed since they did it. They were paper process, we're no longer paper process. So I would try to find, I don't know if your local church might have something, so one of your schools, one of your colleges, your workplace, somebody that you can talk to that's gone through, ideally the buy process and the sell process, so you can get both perspectives and just ready yourself for what you're up against. If they went through an attorney, which is rare, but if they went through an attorney, that's something to consider, but it's not common to do that, only because the realtor's job is to actually help with all that stuff. And there are good realtors and there are terrible realtors, I assure. Try to see if you can find somebody that you can talk through the process from their lens and what they went through to understand it before you go through, and even have them suggest and maybe even go with you on the walkthrough of the home for things they might notice. Obviously, it's all subjective. Things that you like might not be things that they like, and vice versa. Now, I told all that. The reason that I wanted to follow up on that story and about homes in general and people getting out and going forward and the popularity of some of the stuff. The bottom line is this. I had to learn at a very, I don't want to say young, but I was young, age, like my 20s. So I say young quotes. I had to learn at a very young age what I didn't know. And that's a slap in the face that some people are not ready to receive. Some people are not ready to understand what they don't know. And they're not sponges. I'm encouraging everybody to be a sponge for these things that you don't know. Don't worry about the fact you don't know. That's what experience is all about. If you've been coddled, as in parents or somebody else blockaded you away from bad news or negative, whatever, because they wanted you to always smile, they did you a disservice. There's nothing wrong with hearing bad news or this as long as it's intended to help you grow as a person. Going through this process, the first time I went through it, that was a catastrophic mess. If I hadn't gone through the catastrophic mess, I wouldn't have understood how to recognize when it's about to go down that road. Understanding what to do about it is the lessons learned. What would I do different? How would I adjust it? And knowing I'm in a different, completely different locale, so that changes the rules. I just have to understand how it works here and then play the game and make sure that I'm not swindled into something and that I'm in control. Long as you stay in control, which I'll just honestly tell you, you have to embrace pissing people off. And I know culturally that is foreign to a lot of people. You've got to embrace pissing people off. If you hear everything I just told you in this long, I didn't say anything that was a direct insult. I'm telling the truth because I want you to understand this is the real world. And it's going to piss some people off. When you do an inspection on a property and it's finding all these fundamental issues, it's going to piss the seller off. If you're a seller and you get produced this document that's telling you your home is crap, you're going to get pissed off. But that's business. You're saying, this is what it is. Let's move past it. I still want the home. Let's adjust the price. Let's negotiate. A lot of people struggle negotiating. They struggle with, it's just business. It's just a deal. You can't take it personally. The temptation's always there, but you can't take it personally and you can't get set off triggered because somebody's asking you to come down on the price that you thought was a good idea. Because let's be honest, your agent should have already told you, there's no way this price makes any sense. You're way too high. You might say, let's start there and then we'll have a fallback. That's great. Long as there's a plan and you don't take it personally. Could you imagine though, on the rental side, if you had the flexibility to basically do an inspection report on that property and present it to them and tell them, you know what? You got rats in your business and you got jacked up pipes in your business and your lights are all screwed up and all that. And then they have to come down on the rent, but you don't have that power. You don't have that flexibility. You basically got to take whatever garbage they give you. And anybody that's rented in various different places will understand a lot of these are just cesspools. They're not, they don't keep them up to speed. They don't keep them up to, and so they don't want to update them. They do the bare basic minimum and paint over the rest. Paint's cheap. Everything, the fixtures are cheap. The bulbs are cheap. Everything's cheaped out. And you don't have any authority because you're essentially answering to them. And then on top of that, you have to give them first month's rent, last month's rent, a deposit, a thing. You got to give them 60 days notice. They can kick you out in 4 days notice. Like, they hold all the power. And some people, like myself, are simply coded that that's unacceptable and we're tired of it. And so if you're one of those where that's your motivation for considering buying something is being sick of the rat race that is renting, that's why I did this follow-on episode, because I want to empower people to think about more than just the price. It's not just the price. There's so much more to think about. The maintenance is important. The bills are important. The taxes are important. The things that are going to fail are important. Crime is important. The schools are important. Proximity to work, or can you work from home? That's all important. Security is important. So many things you never had to think about before, you now own. But in exchange for that ownership, you run your business, quote unquote, and nobody can tell you what to do other than the state. And the state just makes sure that you pay your taxes. Pay your taxes and you're good. If you're in an HOA, you answer to the HOA and the state, pay your bills and you're good. Outside of that, you have that coverage, you have that freedom, and you're creating generational wealth to pay forward. And that's hard. A lot of us have lost or never had generational wealth to be able to pay forward, because some of us were born in an era where that was not afforded to us, or the laws were slanted away from us. Now, if you could get to that level to where you can start building it, you can help buck the trend and move your family forward. And that's a beautiful thing, because rent's not going to do it. Rents are just going to get higher before they get lower. Some people are fine renting for life. I just was not one of those people. And anybody who's like me, I wanted to help them with some information. Next time, we're back on women under attack, because unfortunately they're under attack. And I want to make sure I give them the time and attention that they so justly deserve.